And we have now the beginning of the recording. So welcome to Tuesday once again. So we were talking, we left off with sort of an intro to records, archives. I broaden it. You know, as y'all may know, one of my specializations is digital museology, digital cultural heritage. So I care not only about records and documents and archives, I also care about stuff. And so part of what I'm going to talk about here when we talk about records and archives is also the informational value of things. I think I've mentioned before that I teach an entire graduate course on getting things to talk and tell you what they mean, i.e. trying to glean the meaning from otherwise mute objects, being able sort of to deconstruct an object to know its origin, to know its place, to know its meaning within the culture that generated it. So what we have then is all manner of stuff that we can consider traces of evidence of earlier activities. Those can be, again, anything from pot shards that might be dug up in eastern Turkey, one of the eight layers of the city of Troy, made famous by the Iliad. We can look at log files. One of the things that I think is becoming very, 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 very interesting for fairly heavy-duty data mining research are the log files of ISPs, the log files of things like YouTube, of Google, etc. And indeed, I was reading earlier today that Google has a contract with the feds to do data mining on log files. Yes, indeed, to try and find the bad guys for the feds. We've got Super 8 movies. One of the problems we have increasingly throughout the 20th century, and we'll see it happen even more and more, is that the traces that get left behind have software and hardware dependencies. How many of us could play a 78 record if we found one? Right. How many of us could play an 8-track tape? Does anybody even know what an 8-track tape is? The kind of big boxes like that. How many of us could play a Nintendo game cartridge? One, two. How about an 8mm film? Right. I mean, all of this stuff, yeah, we can scare up the resources, but it's not easy. I have a bunch of files in my computer right here that were papers I wrote back in the 1980s with a software package called FrameMaker. Well, not only is FrameMaker as software long gone, I don't know of any platform that I can run FrameMaker on, so those documents are, for the most part, inaccessible. So we have a problem of accessibility over time. One of the nice things about papyrus, and the University of Michigan has a huge papyrus collection that they, shall we say, retrieved, some might say stole, from Egypt and the Middle East back in the 1920s. Somehow it's ours and not the Egyptians. Moral problem there that we keep getting back to in museology. But nonetheless, we can look at those papyri, and yeah, there are some software dependencies. How many of us can read whatever language those papyri are written in? But at least we can access the documents. In other words, we don't have to have a machine of a specific generation or variety to read it. So I left off talking about provenance and migrations. Again, and this is a very, very important point, provenance is absolutely vital to understanding how to access and how to order archives. Again, I gave the story of managing to access board of directors minutes by reverse engineering the organization that generated those records. Most historians, frankly, don't understand how that works, and they simply would be told, well, you don't have access to that material, and they'd say, oh, okay, end of story. So one of the most interesting things, one of the most, fun, actually, challenges in doing research is to try and figure out where you can find stuff that you might not expect it to be. And you can follow rules of provenance to do that. But of course, the vast bulk of what humans have communicated to each other in the past is lost. It's in stories, it's in narratives, it's in conversations, It's in little love chatter between people. It's between dissings of people who can't stand each other. In other words, we have a huge disappeared body of human communication, which will always be irretrievable. Now, on top of that, obviously, every culture has had a period that's pre-literate. In the West, we can trace literacy going back, very limited, of course, as I mentioned in the front end of the course, going back about 3,500 years. East Asia, equally far back. But then again, one of the more intriguing problems is how one turns the narratives of a culture into the written documents of a culture. If, for example, you look at the Bible. The first five books of the Bible were basically part of Jewish oral tradition. They survived for centuries from storytellers telling the story to other storytellers, etc. Of course, what happens when you have an oral tradition is you get drift over time, right? You have to keep reinventing the story to make it accessible and to make it meaningful as the context of the listener changes. Writing a text down, an oral narrative down, fixes it in time and freezes it at a certain moment. Again, I'm sure we're all familiar with the tale or the backstory of Homer's writings, the Iliad and the Odyssey. As far as anybody knows, those were around for a couple hundred, maybe many hundreds of years before the blind poet Homer actually wrote them down. Now, if we look at this oral tradition, though, in some cultures, it's fairly tight. One of my favorite examples is in West Africa. There's a tradition called the griot, G-R-I-O-T. And the griot are storytellers in the Senegal River Valley. If you think of the West Africa, there's a big hump that sticks out into the Atlantic Ocean. And the griot are sort of upstream from the city of Dakar. One of my favorite griot is a guy named Fode Moussa Sousso, who is a storyteller. His grandfather was, his great-grandfather was. Within his clan, within his community, he is the last, or the current member, in a very, very long line of griot who tell the story each generation, and it's remembered. And the griot, you know, one of the things you often see with oral narratives of this sort, it was true certainly of Homer, is that there's a musical accompaniment to it. That is, it's partly song, it's partly poetry, and the music and the rhyme scheme, etc., are mnemonics to help remember this, so that you know that when a certain note is hit, you're at a certain chapter of the history of your people. Again, we see this with the griot. We see it quite a bit in India. The state of Bihar has a very rich culture of intergenerational storytellers. But what often happens is that once something is committed to text, it gets frozen. And that sort of living, evolving text in an oral tradition stops. So what we have in the first five books of the Bible, the Talmud, what we have in those five books is a certain moment in the evolution of the Jewish narrative. What we get in Homer is a certain moment of the narrative of, I guess it would be the Ionian people. I can't remember. I'm not that good at ancient history. And you run into some very weird ones. I've been told I can't read Arabic, but I've talked with Arabic-speaking friends of mine that the famous passage, somebody help me out here, the famous passage that's often quoted to the jihadis in the Quran, if you are a martyr for the cause, you will go to heaven and you'll have 70, how many virgins? 72 virgins. You know, I tried to bid it up, but, you know, it didn't work. In various different readings of those texts, those 72 virgins are not really virgins. They are actually white grapes. Yeah, and I'm not sure I'd fly a plane into a building for white grapes. Maybe for 72 virgins, I don't know. But white grapes, not a good deal. In other words, there's all kinds of slippage that happen in translation. You know, again, one of my favorite films is the Bill Murray film Lost in Translation. This guy flying in jet-lagged into Tokyo, not understanding the culture, all kinds of misunderstandings. This is very, very common, not only in the process of writing an oral narrative into a text, but also in translating a text. As you probably know, New Testament scholar is dealing with texts that were originally, the Gospels were originally generated in Aramaic, a language that no longer exists. The closest descendant to it evidently is Chaldean, which is actually spoken more in America than it is in the Middle East these days, since most Chaldeans have left their previous homeland. But in any case, it was written in Aramaic. Aramaic got lost very quickly as a usable language. So most of the canonical editions and the editions of the Gospels that the Council of Nicaea froze as the four legitimate Gospels in the late 4th century were in what was called New Testament Greek, a version of Greek that's no longer around. That it takes considerable training to read. So you can imagine we've got the Bible first going from oral narrative, i.e. almost all of the Gospels were written well after the death of Jesus. So there was a slippage there. Then it was done into Aramaic, then slippage as it goes into New Testament Greek, then slippage as it goes into Latin, then slippage as it goes into English, etc. I have to admit, you know, one of my sort of shocking moments, I'm obviously, as you might have surmised, not much of a churchgoer. I only show up for funerals and marriages. And a neighbor of mine died a few years ago. I was raised as a Protestant, and so, you know, most Protestants use the King James Version with all of those thou arts and that sort of, you know, 16th century English, which, you know, many fundamentalists think that God speaks Elizabethan English. Of course, she doesn't. we won't even get into that debate. But my moment of sort of second take was going to a funeral of a neighbor, and it was a Greek Catholic funeral, and it was in English, you know, and they were reading from the Bible in English, and the Catholic Mass that uses English, I'm sure those of you who are Catholics or raised Catholic could help me out here, they obviously don't use the King James Version. So here they were reading from the Bible, and I had all this expectation of thou arts and all of that stuff, and here they are speaking 20th century English, and it's like, whoa, this isn't religion. You know, you're supposed to be speaking English from centuries ago. But of course, when the Catholic Church switched from the Latin Mass to the vernacular Mass in the 1960s following Vatican II, they certainly weren't going to use the Anglican Bible. They were going to use an updated contemporary translation of the Latin Bible into English. So in other words, there's a lot of slippage that happens at every stage, a lot of sort of mode switching shock that goes on. But one thing is common in these stories, and it's been a disease, frankly, that's infected historical writing until the last couple generations, and that is the overwhelming temptation to write everything as a heroic narrative, to have a savior, whether it's Jesus or Zapata or Achilles or the guy in the water margin, I can't remember, a Robin Hood essentially kind of character. In other words, one of the sort of standard story modes that one constructs a history from a narrative or a document or whatever is to have the great hero, the great conquering hero that will save the world, save the soul, save the empires, free the slaves, you name it, lead people out of Babylon or out of Egypt, whatever the story is, you almost inevitably end up with a great big star. Part of the problem of having the dominant mode of writing and of constructing history as heroic narrative is it writes everybody else out. And because the dominant mode for constructing a memory of the past has for a very long time been about the great leaders, the kings, the warriors, the religious leaders, etc., the lives of everybody else not only tended to get ignored, until very recently, nothing was kept on the lives of everyday people. Writing the history of American slavery, for example, has been very, very difficult to do. Number one, because we know that it was illegal in most of the southern states for slaves to have reading and writing skills. Hence, they were unable to write their stories. We had a few slave owners, and in particular slave owners' wives, who would write the story of the slaves. But they're not going to write the story of the slaves that the slaves would be offering. Yeah. It was Aristotle in the Poetics.
That only histories or the tales of the deeds of great men count as art.
Absolutely.
And everything else is a facsimile and an imperfect reflection of the forms of nature and ideas.
You're mixing Plato and Aristotle, but Plato is talking about this high forms kind of stuff. Aristotle said in the Poetics, look, heroic narrative is the only way to write history. And what that did is it gave us a lot of Alexanders and a lot of Achilles and a lot of Jesuses and a lot of Mao Zedongs, for that matter, and even a lot of Martin Luther Kings and perhaps even an occasional Malcolm X. But it didn't give us the life of everyday people, the lives of people like us. The message of that kind of history, of course, is that we, unless we are great white leaders or whatever, generally male, we are irrelevant. Our lives have no meaning in history. So the challenge for the last couple generations has been to write the history of the non-leaders, the non-heroes, the people who actually made heroism on the part of a few individuals possible. And indeed, getting back just for a moment to the history of slavery, it turns out that the best source that we have for the history of slavery in the U.S. as the slaves had it was serendipitously during the 1930s, the federal government, as part of the New Deal, as part of the Works Projects Administration, hired a bunch of people to interview the last living slaves. And it's called the slave narratives. They're held in, the Library of Congress holds those. Fascinating, fascinating stories. They hired people to interview them, and they interviewed the former slaves. They transcribed the interviews. Interesting thing happened in those. A historian I know went back and tracked some of the interviews, and he found several instances where a former slave would be interviewed by two different people. Interestingly, if the person was a white interviewer, generally female, the story that the former slave would give would be, well, master was not all that bad. We managed to get along. We managed to have some space for ourselves. And, you know, all in all, yeah, slavery was terrible, but, you know, it wasn't that dreadful. Same person being interviewed by a black interviewer said, well, you know, slavery was absolutely hell. They beat the crap out of us. It was miserable, etc. In other words, we get two very, very different stories on that same source. And this is what happens almost any time you do an interview and try and transcribe it and use it as a historical document. It underlines the problem of how you transcribe an oral memory and a collective memory into a text. Which story do you believe then? Do you believe the story that, well, Missy, slavery wasn't all that bad, or do you believe the story, well, brother, slavery was dreadful? Very difficult problem to try and resolve, and the documents don't tell you the story. Yeah?
This may be kind of a stretch, but in race discourse in America today, it seems that kind of schism has led to two different views that are both equally factual.
And the thing, And the thing is, that, you know, I'm actually directing a student on doing a graduate student who's doing some oral history work, and I point out to her, yes, both of these stories are true. Get over it. They are both true simultaneously. And in the universe that we're used to, black and white, or A and, you know, we have the logical law of exclusion that Aristotle gave us, right? If it's A and not A are opposites, they can't coexist. Well, contradictory stories often coexist. And when we try and get the truth out of a historical narrative or out of a historical context, we're frankly following a fool's errand. Because the evidence never tells us the truth. It tells us a truth. It tells us one possible truth. But we can have contradictory truths, and that's perfectly normal. It gives a lot of people a lot of headaches, but it's the postmodern moment that I think we have to live in order to interpret this kind of stuff. So as we transcribe, there are those problems of accuracy. There are those problems of interpretation that are inevitable. There's also the problems of the cost of doing it. I've done a number of oral history narratives, and I have to admit I have violated the rules. What you're supposed to do, best practice when you interview somebody to get historical information, is you tape record it, or you record it in some medium, then you write up a transcript and you submit the transcript to the person you interviewed, they signed off on it, and then you have a real factual piece of work. Who's going to do that? The overhead on doing this kind of stuff is very, very high. And when you think of the overhead in terms of historical conservation, when you think of software and hardware dependent materials, whether it's videotape or whatever, you've got to worry about migration, you've got to worry about the cost of that, you've got to worry about the cost of storage, etc. My favorite example, just parenthetically, that the National Archives came to when there was a case following the first Bush administration, Daddy Bush, called the COINTELPRO case. I won't get into the details, but one of your usual government spying scandals that we get coming out of that sort of administration. And the crux of it was that most of the nasty stuff that was going on was carried on through email. And the first Bush administration said, well, email, that's not a document. That's the equivalent of a hallway conversation or a telephone conversation. It's not a document. Question, folks, how many of you think that email is a document? How many of you would say, well, email, it's really kind of more like a hallway conversation. It's not a record. It's a throwaway. It is a document, right? Exactly what the federal courts finally said. And they said to the first Bush administration, yes, those emails are documents. They have to be archived as public records. They have to follow all of the standard rules of public records. And yes, they can be FOIA'd. That is, journalists can use the Freedom of Information Act to extract those documents. Okay, so following the federal government, the federal court's decision on that, the National Archives said, okay, we have to come up with a policy for how we archive email. Any suggestions how you might archive email? How you might do long-term storage for it? Say what? Print it out. Tell me if there's not a more awkward way to do it. I love electronic stuff because if it's electronic, I can always find it again. You know, in my basement, I've got 8 tubs of files this big, this long, of stuff that I moved with me in 1995, and I haven't opened but one of those tubs. Why? Because I can't find anything in there. You know, I'm sure I could file it very carefully, but if I wanted it back, I'm going to be digging like this, moving all the cat turds and everything else out of, no, you know, moving my basement mess out of the way, and there's that document. If it's electronic, bang, I've got it.
But don't you have to do obsolescence?
Absolutely, but you have to, and this is the crux of the biscuit, you have to make some choices. Because an electronic record for research purposes is far more valuable than a printed document. National Archives said we will print this stuff out. They now have literally thousands of file cabinets full of emails printed out. some of which are, what time do we meet for lunch? Oh, it'll be at 2:30. Can't make it at 2:30. Blah, 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 blah. Look at your email traffic, right? How much of that stuff is really worth keeping? They just print out the whole thing. Oh, my God, what a mess. Unsearchable. Planned obsolescence, right. But the fact is, we can essentially save that email. Conventionally, it's flat text. It's readable by any system. So you just have a huge file of it with tabs and returns and ends of records, and it's that easy. In other words, it's still hardware and software dependent, but you can reduce it to a lowest common denominator to make it migratable across multiple generations of hardware and software. Which raises the question, what happens when archives go digital? What happens when we have records that are, as we call it in the archives biz, born digital? We have a whole set of traditions and practices for dealing with physical objects, physical documents, filing systems, etc. But we really don't know, we really don't have a good system or a good set of best practices yet for what to do with electronic records. One of my favorites, by the way, I just ran across this last week, the best genealogy database in the world. Any guesses? Who has the best genealogy database?
Iceland,
actually, Iceland, yeah, you're actually right, and I was wrong. Second best one in the world. Iceland's very good because Iceland has a population that's been on that island for like 1,000 years or so. More than that. They moved there in 700-800 or so. So they've been there for, 1,500 years, give or take. It's a well-known population, well-bounded, etc. But the largest database of genealogy in the world? Any guesses?
The Human Genome Project.
Human Genome doesn't really do that much genealogy. Genealogy meaning family descent, family trees. Turns out it's the Mormons. Why would it be the Mormons? This has really pissed off a number of Jews, by the way. Under Mormon theology, a person who's already saved can be converted to Mormonism. A person who's already dead can be converted to Mormonism after the fact, and their soul can be saved after they're dead. Yes. So the Mormon Church has invested millions upon millions of dollars. I remember when I was going in courthouses doing research in the late 1970s, time and time again, I'd run into these Mormons who are sitting there just going through birth and death records and probate files, recording genealogies. Why? So that somebody downstream could save somebody else's great-great-granduncle. It's very weird. And if you want to see a group that really got annoyed by this, of course, Jews have very good, generally tend to have very good tracking of their own genealogy. Because, the religion goes through the mother, which gives you a a good strong base to go along with the paternity line. You can well imagine that a number of Jews got a little annoyed when they found that the Mormons were saving their grandfathers after they were dead. It turns out as well currently that one of the favorite sources for identity theft is indeed the Mormon database of identities. They've made a good bit of that available to the public, and it's created some really annoying kind of situations. In any case, when you have these electronic records, it's a question of where do you put them, how do you store them. One of the nicer things that's happened in the last couple decades is the scanning and archiving of old documents into huge new document systems. One of the greatest projects of this sort was supported by a Spanish banker back in the 1980s who decided to go to Seville. Seville was the hub of the Spanish Empire in the New World, and managed to, with the Spanish government's permission, scan basically every single document of the Spanish colonial system. So if you wanted to read the land grant of some viceroy who was, you know, a friend of Ferdinand or Isabel, who managed to get, you know, X number of square kilometers of Brazil, not Brazil, of Mexico, with an allocation of X thousand slaves and Indians, etc., you can find those documents there. Problem number one, though, fabulous project, but all done on a software and a hardware platform that's no longer used, and it hasn't been migrated. So we have a huge, valuable electronic resource, literally the entire history of the Spanish Empire, that was scanned and is now inaccessible. Obviously, it'll take some work and it can be migrated, but it was done in such a way at the time they thought it was best practice, turned out not to be. We are. That's one of the things we do in the School of Information, is we worry quite a bit about migration. It is, I think, one of the top problems we have to deal with. Migration is tricky, though. You know, as you know, we have the Google Book Project, or what? Google Book. It used to be called Google Print, right?
I don't know, whatever.
Whatever, but it's Google Print now. Yeah. In any case, as you probably know, Google is scanning all of the volumes in the U of M library. It's unclear what the copyright status is. It's very messy. But there's also a question, what are they going to do to scan some of these really poor material kinds of stuff? Like, you've got a book that if you open it up, it falls apart in your hand. Particularly knowing that scanning puts heat and light on historical resources and on paper that might be incredibly fragile. So you've got to be incredibly careful in moving this stuff forward. So we have a problem then of migration. We have a problem of born digital. We have a very real problem within government all over the US and all over the world today. Basically, starting in the late 1970s and very much in the 1980s, more and more governments, obviously, moved over to using computers to handle their everyday transactions, to keep their records, etc. Agencies were doing this through the 80s and through the 90s, and what do you think the archivists were worrying about in the 80s and 90s? What do you think the archival profession was really focused on? They were looking at the backlog from the 1800s and the 1900s and saying, well, you know, in another 30 years, we'll get done with the 19th century. Meanwhile, units of government are creating terabytes upon terabytes of digital information for which there was basically no policy. Where did it go? How did it get stored? What were the record schedules, as they call them, i.e. what was the plan to deal with those records, basically did not exist. I think the most difficult problem for your grandchildren will be to write the history of the last quarter of the 20th century. We have good paper records, but nobody was keeping track of the electronic stuff. Sure, a lot of it got printed out and stuck in file cabinets, and those file cabinets, you can imagine, are huge and voluminous and irretrievable. So we do have a very deep problem of a memory hole of that historical period. Again, I've mentioned whether we print to paper, how we keep it, how we migrate it, how we move it forward, the problems of dependencies. We also have questions of custodianship. If you have electronic records, who keeps them? Who's responsible for them? The agency that generated them? Do they have the resources for long-term storage? Probably not. Do they have the wherewithal to understand records migration? Probably not. So you end up with a number of very, very complicated issues. You also end up with issues of the ability to change the historical record. I'm sure none of you remember the famous Perry Mason TV series. I barely remember it. It was big in the 1950s. Perry Mason was his attorney. And it was your sort of early version of the courtroom drama, the Catch 'em and Cook 'em of the Law and Order variety, not nearly as dumb as the CSI variety. But you'd have, you know, The basic scenario was that there'd be a guy on the stand and there'd be a trial going on, and then Perry Mason, the heroic attorney, would pull out irrefutable photographic evidence as fact. And the photo does not lie, because photos never lie. And a document is a fixed entity that cannot be changed. Is that true anymore? I mean, I got emailed a document from one of my, shall we say, rather shadier friends of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton having sex. I thought, why hasn't Drudge picked up on this? Well, obviously it was a Photoshop job. And we're in an era now where, you know, the originality, what's the original document? You know, when you generate a paper for a class, what's the original? What's the copy?
Google's making it worse now. Do you have custom time?
No, we really have to move forward. But we run into these problems. Here's a very good example that I ran across on the web. You know, one can have, shall we say, a picture of a regular everyday person, and, you know, maybe we could use that Israeli software I was talking about earlier, that offensive stuff that can tell you who's beautiful and who's not. Obviously, she's not a blonde shiksa, so by their algorithms, she's probably not beautiful. But a little Photoshop work can do wonders. You can take the one on the right. Let's do that again. I just love this trick. So look at the one on the left, and she goes from, kind of looks like she's been working too long at the bar. Oh. And on the right, oh, how do you do this? Don't you wish you could do this with your own life? probably not. My point here, though, is that the evidence can be changed. And if the evidence can be changed in midstream, if documents can be changed after the fact without leaving a trace, which is quite common, if that can happen, then accountability becomes very, very difficult. If indeed that contract between the Bushies and Custer battle, or the more recent one we heard about, I don't know if y'all saw this in the Times, it was really scary, where there was some shade tree contractor had a contract to supply ammunition to the forces in Afghanistan and managed to go to Eastern Europe and find warehouses of 40-year-old AK-47 cartridges and sold those. Do they work? Do they jam up the guns? It's a mess. Those documents can all be fixed after the fact. You know, they can say, well, the contract didn't really say that, and it doesn't leave a trace. Because accountability is at the center of why we need archives. It can speak truth to power. It can say, look, we know what you did. We can follow the money, as Benjamin Bradley famously said in the Watergate case. We can deconstruct the organization, find who wrote those memos about torture. Was it John Yoo? Was it David Addington? Who was it? Well, actually, we can know that if we can get those records. We can hold those people accountable for the tortures at Guantanamo, at Abu Ghraib. We can hold them accountable because they did leave a record, we hope. But of course, those records can be erased. Some of these get really strange. You know, we have a basic sort of mentality that I think is very good in the U.S. We call it transparency. The Europeans are even bigger on it. That is that if there's knowledge, if there's facts, if there's acts of government, those should be out there in the sunshine for everybody to see. I think it was Justice Brandeis of the Supreme Court who, on the subject of accountability, records accountability, said sunshine is the best disinfectant. That is, if you bring these documents out into the light of day, then those in power will be held accountable. And we usually think, well, bad guys probably bury their tracks. My favorite bad guy covering his tracks was J. Edgar Hoover. Does the name J. Edgar Hoover ring a bell? For a few, J. Edgar Hoover was the head of the FBI. Very strange fellow. He was originally hired by the feds before the FBI was formed in the 20s to chase the commies, chase the communists after the end of the First World War. His agency went after people like Emma Goldman, for example, throwing out mostly Jewish leftists, deporting them, etc. Actually got a few Italian anarchists in the process as well. J. Edgar Hoover for years and years claimed, well, there is no such thing as the mafia. He was absolutely fixated on two things, communists and gays. And boy, when he found a gay communist, he just about went batso. J. Edgar Hoover, how do you stay in power? He was the head of the FBI. I remember the day he died. We all danced and had a party. He died in 1971, spring of 71. When I was in college, and so he lasted as the head of the FBI for close to half a century. How do you survive for half a century? Blackmail, you got the goods on everybody. He knew who John F. Kennedy was banging at late night in the White House. He knew what John F. Kennedy was taking for pain medication. He knew what Mamie Eisenhower was doing. He knew Eleanor Roosevelt was having intimacies with. Basically, he had the goods on absolutely everybody. Believe me, when JFK became president in January of 1961, his brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, said, "We're sick and tired of this right-wing wacko, J. Edgar Hoover, staying in power and, you know, using his fixations on the public." You know, he was very anti-gay, but this didn't preclude him from, this is so weird, he was a cross-dresser, and so he, you know, in the privacy of his own home, put on a little party dress and dance around. Totally whack guy. I'm not saying, you know, transvestism is good or bad, but for somebody who's fixated on gays, this guy needed therapy. So RFK tried to go after him, and J. Edgar Hoover's response was, "I got the goods on you guys." Every time somebody said, "Can we see the records that you have on us?" he would say, "No." Now, there are federal records laws that say that, look, if an agency generates a record, it goes into a file. I remember when I worked for New York State, the standard statement was, okay, that goes to file. It's a standard bureaucratic phrase. Well, the FBI had a favorite file called the Do Not File file. This was a file that didn't exist as a file. And this was a file that had all sorts of allegations about senators' gay trysts and things like this. Most of it largely scurrilous stuff. A lot of very third-party kind of BS. You can find the link to the contents of that file on the course website. So J. Edgar Hoover was a little weird, but at least he tried to bury his tracks. Unlike the Khmer Rouge. The Khmer Rouge, for those of you unfamiliar, very carefully archived and photographed and collected and neatly lined up the skulls of the roughly 1 million people that they killed between 1973 and 1975 in Cambodia, or Kampuchea, or whatever it's currently called. Kept very careful records. Now, why would they do this? Why did the Nazis keep fairly careful records of the people that they sent to the ovens? Unknown. Unknown. Sometimes this happens, and you know, you look at this stuff, and you're just aghast. Did they think that they were virtuous in murdering these people? You never know. In any case, we do still have problems. Over the years, because of American and even more European culture, having an insistence, growing insistence on transparency, that basically by default, every government record should be public unless there's a damn good reason for it not to be, i.e. the default condition is that it should be public. That tradition has been growing, or had been growing, for a couple generations following the Second World War. More and more Freedom of Information Acts were passed. I'll talk about those in a while. But after 9/11, we reverted. More and more we were told, look, you the public cannot know, because if we're told, for example, one of my favorites, the federal government had released a whole bunch of records from the early 1950s, right? Early Cold War stuff, you know, they even released the records about trying to kill Fidel Castro with exploding cigars. I mean, all manner of really stupid stuff, right? So they let, you know, they released a bunch of records, totally harmless. I mean, is there any intelligence value to the exploding cigar story? I don't think so. But the feds, you know, released all of this stuff, well, about, what was it, 5-6 years ago now? They reclassified a bunch of stuff that had already been released. Yeah, they tried to put the toothpaste back in the tube. It's illegal, of course, for any of us as citizens or any of our institutions to hold secret documents, classified documents. Well, it turns out that the Bush administration retroactively reclassified a whole bunch of documents that had been declassified. A number of those documents were in published volumes sitting on the shelves of the University of Michigan Library. So all of a sudden, on a given Tuesday afternoon, the University of Michigan was in deep violation of federal law simply for the stuff that they had gotten from the federal government and put on their shelves. One of the key documents that I'm sure all of you will appreciate the high security classified value of are balloon flights over Czechoslovakia in 1950. I tell you, that really compromises national security, and I just committed a federal crime by telling you about those balloon flights. I invite you to turn me in to the Ministry of Homeland Security for violating federal law. And it sounds silly when we're talking about balloon flights over Czechoslovakia, a country that no longer even exists, right? That was part of a Cold War configuration of power that disappeared shortly after y'all were born. I mean, give me a break. This is ridiculous. But we're not allowed to know the names of the people who were caught in the dragnet in Afghanistan. When there was a bounty after 9/11, the federal government basically said, look, we're looking for bad guys, Taliban, Al-Qaeda members running around loose in Afghanistan, and we will give anybody who turns in one of these guys $X. I think it was $300 to $500, $5,000 for the high value people. And so essentially anybody who found this little memo from the federal government found anybody who looked like they didn't, you know, maybe had sex with their sister and they were pissed off, so they grabbed them and said, here's your terrorist, right? No accountability, no nothing. All it were the words of these bounty hunters. They got stuck in Guantanamo Bay. We as citizens ask, who got stuck in Guantanamo Bay? And we're told, you're not allowed to know. Were they tortured at Guantanamo Bay? You're not allowed to know. How do you know that these were bad guys? You're not allowed to know. How do we know that these are actually bad guys? You're not allowed to know. The more that this happens, the less the government is accountable, the more we have the kind of state that George Orwell warned us so deeply about. One of my favorite provisions of the Patriot Act is that librarians can be told to turn over lists of patrons of who's been reading what. Do not take my warning, I mean, please take my warning seriously. Do not go to the University of Michigan Library and start reading jihadi websites. Don't start reading jihadi literature. Don't check out the article in the Progressive magazine from the late 1970s that tells you how to make an atomic bomb. That is tracked. It can be traced. And a librarian can get an order from the federal government that says, turn over the files about who's been reading the Quran, who's been reading the Anarchist Cookbook, they can say that. You know what the librarians have done? I'll get to you in a second, Annalise. You know what the librarians have done in response? They've said, sorry, we don't keep circulation records anymore. Thank you. I don't like the idea of destroying records, but if it is to preserve the privacy and the integrity of patrons, I totally agree with librarians doing it. Annalise? Excellent. Did the librarian tell this story? Because you realize it's illegal to know that fact. You probably just violated federal law yourself. I'll
edit it out of the podcast.
So the FBI doesn't come after you. Yeah, I mean, the librarians aren't even allowed to say that they have gotten a request. I'm appalled. What the hell were they looking for?
I have no idea.
And they're certainly not going to tell you either. It's this sort of thing, and you look at it, and you get this kind of chill. You know, it's like, what are they looking for? What's the point? I mean, it must be that huge Middle Eastern community you have up on the Keweenaw Peninsula. You know, and the huge, all of the mosques up there, I'm sure, are full of jihadis up in the UP. I tell you, they can be dangerous, you know. Arabic with a Upper accent, you know. The idea just makes my head want to explode. Okay, more about accountability. I have to get moving here. Again, closed records. One of the strategic ways that governments make you think you're getting transparency is by having published documents. There's a series that the State Department publishes called FRUS, Foreign Relations of the U.S. It's a published State Department CIA diplomatic papers of the U.S. government. They publish it as a way of saying, here are the historical resources that historians can use to write the history. Well, we got one in the mail the other day of Europe in the 1970s, I think it was, 69 to 74, volume about this big. I know this because my wife sits on this committee. She has a top secret security clearance to look at these records and decide which ones are going to be made public and which aren't. She's annoyed to no end by the committee. She has a top secret clearance, so they actually sniffed around and said, what was your husband doing back in those years? Who are your friends? What countries have you been to? All of those kinds of things. I mean, she's a professor. We're pretty damn harmless. We can say a lot of stuff, but, you know, frankly, we're a bunch of hot air and huff and puff, as you all know. But, you know, they did the security clearance. My point, though, is that by strategically publishing and releasing some records, the public is urged to believe that that's what the history is. A good example of the Foreign Relations of the U.S. series was the initial volume that came out on Latin America between 1966 and 1975, give or take. I'm not sure those are the exact dates, but essentially, a few years plus or minus 1970. If you're familiar with what was going on in Latin America in that period, it was a very hot period. Remember, Fidel took over Cuba. The Cuban Revolution happened in 1959. Che Guevara, one of the leaders of the revolution, the guy who's on so many of our cool t-shirts, Che Guevara was going around Latin America trying to mobilize peasants to overthrow these very, very crusty, reactionary, aristocratic governments that were the leftover detritus of the Spanish Empire. In other words, there was a lot of revolution in the air across Latin America in the late 1960s, and there were a lot of revolutionaries in Latin America trying to overthrow not only these very conservative, right-wing, oftentimes military regimes, they were also questioning the power of the American multinationals, Anaconda Copper, the coffee companies in Brazil, the rubber companies, the sugar companies throughout the Caribbean, etc., obviously the banana companies in Central America. Obviously, the U.S. government did not think highly of these people. They tended to assassinate them. They tended to do all manner of, shall we say, rather ugly things to these liberation movements across Latin America. In particular, Chile had its 9/11 in 1973. On the 11th of September of 1973, the legally elected government of Chile under Salvador Allende, a coalition, a left of center coalition government, was overthrown by an American-backed military coup. We all knew it at the time. I remember the moment. I remember the tragedy. I remember the people I knew who were there. I don't know anybody who died, but I know what happened. We all knew it. When the volume of Frus came out that covered the Chilean coup, Henry Kissinger was up to his neck in the murders. When that volume came out, what did it say? Oh, the Chilean Navy on its own overthrew the duly elected government. It was absolute unvarnished crap. It was a lie. The government put it out there in an effort to make the public believe what all of us knew was false. Fortunately, the committee overseeing the publication of Frus saw that volume and come out and they said, this won't fly. You're not going to release documents telling the story the way you're telling it, because that is not the truth. The truth is, in fact, that our government overthrew that duly elected government, which oversaw the murder of thousands of people at the hands of the military dictatorship. They have got to publish that fact. And indeed, in the revised volume on Latin America in that period, there is some truth. But there had to be an intervention for that to happen. It's scary, because we never know in that process of publication what's getting cleansed and what's getting emphasized as being the real story. Because there's an effort, of course, to cover the tracks of the corporate interests, of the CIA, of the secret killers. Another problem in the federal government with our federal structure when we look within the U.S. is that you never know who to ask. If there's surveillance going on, is it the local police? Is it the state police? Is it the Red Squad? A good friend of mine was studying the relationship between the communists and the NAACP in Schenectady, New York, where GE was huge back in the 1950s, right at the beginning of the Cold War. And it was very, very clear that the place was overrun with all manner of spies, looking at the communists, looking at the union, looking at the NAACP people, because the assumption, of course, was that the civil rights movement was entirely a creature of the Communist Party. This was one of J. Edgar Hoover's fixations. Meanwhile, by the way, the NAACP was doing everything it possibly could to disassociate itself from the communists, much the way that many of the members of the African National Congress tried to distance themselves from the South African Communist Party. That said, what my friend did was he was trying to research this. He went to the federal government. He knew. He had talked to people who knew who the spies were from the FBI, he said. So he goes to the FBI. He files a Freedom of Information Act. He says, look, I need the records on this. I'm a historian. I'm researching what went on in Schenectady in the late 1940s and early 50s. The FBI's response, we didn't have any spies there. Who, us? We wouldn't spy on American citizens. Give me a break. But, like me, he understood archives. And he knew that not only did the FBI have its people spying on the labor movement and spying on the NAACP, so did the New York State Police. And, of course, they shared records, something that's rare among government agencies, as we know, after 9/11. But in this instance, they actually were sharing these Red Squad records. So he wanted the records. Where did he go? To the New York State Police. He said, I'd like to see the surveillance records of spies. New York State Police say, fine, we don't have a problem. We don't have anything to hide. So he managed to find out the spying on the NAACP and on the UE and on United Electrical Workers and on the communists. But it does create a problem. One finds themselves with a FOIA request, oftentimes in a through-the-looking-glass situation. Which agency do you go to? Oh, they weren't our spies. Go to this agency. Oh, they weren't our spies. Go to this agency. It's an endless paper chase of who is actually accountable. Another problem, too, is you notice in everything I have said thus far about accountability, I've only talked about government. When we talk about archives, and it's a tradition of the archives profession going all the way back to ancient Greece, going all the way back to the first archivist known, who was Lao Tse, the famous founder of Taoism, was, as far as we know, the world's first archivist. Archivists always worked with the archons, to use the Greek term. An archon, if you know Star Trek, there was a whole episode of Star Trek with the archons. The archons were the rulers in ancient Greece. They were the magistrates. The archives were the records of the magistrates, of the archons. So traditionally, archives have always been about documenting government. Now, if you look at the 20th century, probably not a bad idea. In other words, if you want to write the history of the 20th century, writing it based on government records is probably a good start, right? The most powerful institution in most people's lives. What we've seen happen, though, in the U.S. since the 1980s is that the government has moved out of our lives in a large sense. The most dominant institutions in our lives today, I would argue, are not public institutions, but corporations. They determine our standard of living. They determine our accessibility to education. They determine our accessibility to travel. They determine all kinds of the contours of our lives. Arguably, we have created a real mess in archives by traditional archival practices. By assuming that the government is the most dominant institution in our lives, we've created a huge memory hole. Corporate America is not accountable. If we want to write the history of the late 20th century and of the 21st century, we won't be able to do it. We won't be able to know what banks decided that they were going to kill which neighborhoods in Cleveland. We won't be able to know what the subprime loans were going to poor people that almost revived urban neighborhoods across America, and then the loans got called in. We will not know the history of those neighborhoods. We will not know the history of Detroit. The history of Detroit, believe me, is not going to be written by the text messages of Kwame Kilpatrick. The history of Detroit will be written, if ever, by the records of General Motors, of Ford, of Roger Penske, and of whatever the guy's name was, the casino guy. The guy who lost the casino battle, can't remember his name. Big entrepreneur guy. My point here is that the fixation on the public side on record keeping has blinded us to the fact that if we're going to write the history of the current period, we have to have access to the private records. But a corporation under American law has the same privacy rights as you do. Just as I cannot go and look at Annalise's financial records, I can't snoop into her bank account. I can't snoop into the accounts of Halliburton. I can't snoop into the accounts of corporations like Blackwater, based out of Grand Rapids, Michigan, run by a cousin of the DeVos family, a relative of the DeVos family out of Grand Rapids, a company that knows no rules, that is armed and dangerous and kills whoever it feels like killing in Iraq and is not accountable. I can't get those records. I cannot say, look, this company, Blackwater, has given my country, the U.S., a terrible reputation in the world. We cannot hold them accountable. Why? They're private individuals. They are not accountable.
Could the government subpoena that information?
Yeah, maybe. If we had a government that wasn't partners with them.
Or if that information exists in the first place.
There's always a way to hit the delete button, isn't there? And this is indeed what happened when the Blackwater investigation started. You know, you might recall, I guess it was August or so of last year, there was an incident where Blackwater went into an Iraqi town square and basically just did a spray down of the locals. I think they killed 9-10 people. Just
19.
Say what?
19
people. Okay, you know, just a standard AK spray down, you know, the kind of thing that Blackwater seems to do for, you know, they're only ragheads, who cares, right? So they just kill them in large numbers and differently. When the feds, or when Congress tried to investigate, lo and behold, bingo, records are gone. They just hit the delete button.
Oh, you should have seen the committee hearings and how aloof.
I did.
Yeah, how aloof he was
mm-hmm.
to the government's inquiry.
Yeah, Prince, what a name.
because he knows that
his butt's covered. His butt is totally covered. He has friends in high places. How do you think he got the contracts? Maybe by being related to a DeVos in Michigan? The backbone of... Say what?
Blackwater's now working on contracts to train African Union soldiers in southern Sudan.
Yeah. I mean, they're neck deep in everything. My point, though, is we have to keep these people accountable. We can thank the Attorney General of the state of California for getting the records and squeezing hard by discovering that in a 6-month period, citizens of the state of California overpaid their electricity bills by $15 billion. Why? Because Enron figured out a way to game the system. Basically, they shut down a bunch of power plants, waited for the price to go up, and nailed the consumers to the wall. The city of Los Angeles alone got screwed for millions and millions of dollars by overt market manipulation coming out of Enron. How do we know this? Only because, as Brendan alluded to, the Attorney General, I think his name is Lockyer. No, that's not right. Whatever the Attorney General's name was, subpoenaed those records. We all knew what was going on. It was obvious what was going on. There was overt manipulation going on, ripping off people to the tune of billions of dollars. We knew what was going on, but it took a subpoena from a state attorney general to do it, to uncover what Enron was doing. And they'll hide behind intellectual property claims. We cannot know how the voting machines work. Under DMCA, remember our intellectual property stuff? Under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, if you sit down, as Ed Felton of Princeton has done, and you try and reverse engineer how a Diebold voting machine works, so you can be sure that the voting machine isn't reallocating votes behind your back, as the Diebold machines have done time and time again. If you can't win an election fair and square, you can fix the votes, right? We know that in Zimbabwe. We know that in Kenya. We now know that in America. We cannot hold them accountable if we can't see the code. And they say, business secrets, copyright, DMCA, we're not accountable, get the hell out of my office, end of story. What this means in the end is that as our public space gets more and more delimited, as it becomes increasingly privatized, as Main Street gets replaced by the shopping mall, as a public venue gets replaced by a private venue, as the influences in our lives are more and more coming from private organizations, we can have all of the Freedom of Information Acts we want. But we do not have the way to hold private entities responsible. Yes, we can subpoena records if we can get standing in court. But it's not easy. Most judges will tell you, hey, you're not a party to this suit. Class action suits were always a good way to get the resources together through civil litigation to get records discovery so we can hold these people accountable. Every time you hear the term tort reform, recognize that behind the term tort reform is an agenda to keep private corporations and business interests from being held accountable to the public. Because when you try and get the records on a corporation, what do you get? Anybody ever read a corporate annual report or a 10-K? I invite you to do it. You've seen them? Is there anything of substance in there? I mean, they're really pretty, right? And you read them and it's like, things are just all good. I remember I had a great aunt who had bought some American Safety Razor stock back in the 1930s, and by the time she died in the early 90s, American Safety Razor had long ago been bought by Philip Morris. So Philip Morris of Marlboro fame, Marlboro man, you know, the three Marlboro, two, was it two or three Marlboro men who died of lung cancer, whatever it was. So she ended up holding $600,000 worth of Philip Morris stock. So in dealing with her stuff, you know, I was one of her few descendants. In dealing with her stuff, I ran across corporate reports from Philip Morris. And you would not think that Philip Morris had been responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands, if not millions, of people. You'd read it and it was like, oh, new expanding markets in Asia. Oh, as the American market is declining, we're discovering new markets abroad. A promising future for the tobacco industry. Yes, it's all good. There are those millions of women in China who don't yet smoke. So for every American smoker who is no longer smoking, we can replace them with five Chinese women and give them ads that say, I'm liberated, just as they did to American women in the 1920s. We all remember Lauren Bacall in the famous film. What was the line? Just put your lips together and blow. Charming. That's the information you get from a corporate report. Are you going to hold Philip Morris responsible on those grounds? I don't think so. Thanks very much.